Welcome, everybody. I'm Richard Krause. I hope you're staying happy, healthy, and safe. We have a big show for you today. Later, Jim Cuddy stops by to talk about making music during the pandemic and what it's going to be like when we're finally able to go see live music again. Also, we'll meet Nigel Irwin. He's a musician and co-creative director of Nagamo, the world's first indigenous-created music library for media. We'll get to that in just a little bit. First up, let me introduce Strippers Union, a Canadian supergroup, although, as you'll find out, they don't really like that term. Comprised of members of the Tragically Hip and the Odds, if the band name sounds familiar, it's because Rob Baker of the Hip and Craig Northey of the Odds have released two other successful albums under that name. In 2005, they released their debut album, Strippers Union Local 518, and in 2011, they released their second album, The Deuce. After a 10-year break, they're back with a double album called The Undertaking. I had to start by asking Craig, why wait 10 years to release the new album?
Rob's life got pretty complicated there for a bit. That ate up some years. Mm-hmm. And mine is always pretty busy. Maybe everyone has stuff they're doing, and we've all got a lot of irons in the fire. So I don't know where time goes. It feels like we just get in a time machine, and we're here. We're putting out a record.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, Rob. Does it feel like no time had passed when you finally start working together again?
Yeah. I'm sure you have a best friend who you rarely see. Mm-hmm. And when you get together, it's just you fall in like you're together all the time. You pick up the conversation where you left it 10 years ago and you keep going. And I'm fortunate to have a couple of friends like that. And Craig is certainly first and foremost. So, yeah, 10 years, it didn't feel like 10 years between, but when I look at the number of songs that I sort of had done demos for and started rolling out for Craig, it was like, wow, there are a lot of songs here.
Well, I'm told there were 50 songs. That is a lot of songs. Tell me a little bit about how you collaborate. You live in different parts of the country. You don't see one another every day. How do you work on it? Rob, I'm told from what I've been reading that you contribute mostly to the music. Craig, you are more on the lyrical side, but it's a true collaboration. Tell me a little bit about how it works.
Yeah, I have a home studio, and there isn't much that I'm any good at. So I like to play the guitar, and I like to explore playing the bass, and programming drums, and playing keyboards, and pedal steel, and mandolin, and banjo, and anything I can get my hands on to play harmonica. And I amuse myself. I make my ego and my problems go away by just jumping into the creative vat in my studio and seeing what I can shake loose. So I do these demos, and for reasons that I've never been able to fully explain other than what I just explained, I work up these demos and try and make them as great as I can, but they're just, it's music, no lyrics in, you know, probably 19 out of 20 cases, there are no lyrics. And when Craig makes his way east, or I make my way west, I'll usually, you know, pour a couple of drinks into him and then pin him to the ground and make him listen to a bunch of ideas. And hope that one excites him. And if it does, we chat for 20 minutes and he takes a thread of what we've been talking about and spins it into a song.
Tell me about that. What is it when you hear these unfinished songs? Is it just a melody that grabs you? What is it?
It's all of it, all of the above, whichever you were going to say after melody.
Yeah.
It's those things. I mean, I think it's a texture and an emotion that comes from it, really, and a feeling. Melody's part of it. And I just get, Rob, you know, from now it's Dropbox, before it was mailing CDs, showing up and just pressing the space bar on his computer and listening to stuff, and having him be enthusiastic about something is really helpful too. I mean, I really love this one. There's something in here. And we start talking, and we start talking about something that's happening in our lives. And then I realize, oh, that idea connects with that feeling, and I start throwing words at it. So it's a smorgasbord for me. There's just a lot to choose from, and I just cherry pick the cool ones.
You're listening to my interview with Craig Northey and Rob Baker of Strippers Union. Find their album, The Undertaking, wherever you legally rent or download music. And it's been 10 years since the last album. Do you think that there's a difference in the style of songs? 10 years, things change, people change. Have the songs changed?
I think so. Rob might not think so. I don't know. I think this album sounds different than the others. We're very fleshed out with horn arrangements, and they have strings. Strings. And we were together more, mm-hmm. but here there's a real vision of Rob's, and all the music you hear is really all Rob. And then everybody realizes, oh, if I just add this one thing, if we just tilt the camera a little bit to this way, then it's all going to resonate. And so you carefully find your place in it.
And Rob, for you, what's your take on that?
I have a special place for all the records, but I mean, all three of them.
Yeah.
This one, I feel the most connected to. Like, I feel this one's really... Yeah. The one thing that I think makes them interesting records for me, and interesting listen and satisfying for me, is how eclectic they are. Mm. But eclectic can be a danger, because it can be unfocused. And I think that this record maybe has more focus than the last one. Last one, I really liked the record, and it was eclectic, certainly. But there's just... this one feels even more eclectic and yet more focused.
We are the underworld. We are the underworld. Yeah, we are the underworld. We are the underworld.
The Georgia Strait recently said that this new album sounds like the Kinks for our generation. How do you respond to that?
I love that.
Bless their hearts.
I think... that's probably one of the coolest things I've ever heard, but I probably know how Bruce Springsteen felt, you know. Live up to that.
Yeah. Let's talk about, in my reading about Strippers Union, the word supergroup kept coming up over and over again. A, do you like the term? And B, when you think about back to rock and roll history, there's been so many super groups that have gotten together. Is there a favorite super group for either of you?
Well, I would say I hate the term super group.
And why?
But CSNY, for me, they were a great band.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by.
Supergroup. No, Craig and I are just musicians, and we're kind of brothers from different mothers. So the first time we met, we fell in like we'd known each other our whole lives. Mm. And we grew up, you know, I didn't realize this until we were recording Pat and Doug putting down the bass and drums, and Craig and I were sitting back listening, and he said, what's the first album you ever bought with your own money? And I told him, and his was the same.
So, and what was it?
It was kind of an American greatest hits compilation of the Beatles, the Hey Jude album.
Yeah.
And do you still have your old copies of it?
Oh yeah. I just did a podcast all about it with my actual copy in my hand.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And Craig, for you, the idea of supergroup, and is there a group that would be labeled a supergroup that sticks out for you?
Well, I totally concur with Rob. It's just musicians getting together, but I'd say Gorillaz lately, you know, that's a pretty amazing thing to happen. And a lot of talented people flow through that. And so more, I'd see it as a collective, like what happened with the Hip and Odds and all these bands, Bare Naked Ladies, Pals, you know, like I collaborate with Stephen Page, and the way that musicians come together, there's a chance that something will happen. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's not so much supergroup. It's just musical ideas and minds meeting.
Rob, in the notes that I read that you had written, I love when you say, "I've never played guitar or written tunes because it was a job, a living, or a paycheck. I do it because it's what I do. It's a natural extension of me." And so how much time do you spend writing? Where does inspiration come? Do you write every day, or does inspiration hit you like a lightning bolt sometimes? How does that work?
All kinds of ways. Sometimes you have nothing, so you just strap on your skates and you bang the puck against the boards, which in my case would be picking up, you know, maybe I pick up a nylon string guitar and I just read classical arrangements and play, or I work out jazz standards for finger style. Whatever it is, it just keeps your fingers moving and it keeps me focused on music and playing. And it keeps my mind from wandering into the dark corners where it has a tendency to want to go. And I really believe this, that people run or they do yoga or they paint, they work out, whatever, they play music. They're all doing it for exactly the same reason. And it's that you want to shut out all that other noise, all the little voices in your head, all the dark stuff that's happening, your troubles, nattering away, pulling at the threads of your life. And if you can focus your energy into something creative or yoga or running, you just push all those things away and you exist in the moment like a dog. And it's a happy place. That's my happy place, and that's why I do it.
It's amazing how a guitar to Rob or myself transforms you instantly. If I see one in the room, I'm staring at it while I'm talking. Like I'm looking at those ones over Rob's shoulder right now going, I need to like I got a whole bunch here. Yeah. And as soon as I pick it up or I touch it, I'm a different person. I'm in my own space. It's kind of distracting. It's like the hockey game being on while you're playing a show, right? You know, on the TVs. You're a different person at that time. You go, and those dark thoughts that Rob's talking about, sometimes it quells them, but sometimes you pick up your instrument and you ride one of them all the way to the end. You know, yep. you just take one. It allows you to focus on one of them and ride it out and discover what it's really doing to you.
And how has it been for each of you during the pandemic where there are no live shows? Are you finding it a well of creativity because you are, I suppose, at home more and you're able to work more? Or is it more difficult because of the circumstance?
I don't know. For some, it's different for everybody. My life hasn't changed that much, except that I'm not trying to do everything at once. There's one element missing. Right. So I have added a bunch of those things in, but I also do music for television, and that's an all-consuming, life-crushing thing when there's a deadline. Right. So you tend to sort of forget everything. You have that experience that we're talking about, only it's forced on you. It's coming at you like a tidal wave. So during the pandemic, I've been able to finish the Strippers Union record, finish an Odds record, do those kind of things, but I don't feel any different. I don't feel like there's was more time, because like, as Rob said, you just do it. You get up and you do it.
You're listening to my interview with Craig Northey and Rob Baker of Strippers Union. Find their new album, The Undertaking, wherever you legally download or buy music. Yeah. And Rob, for you?
Yeah, maybe fewer things pulling me away from what I want to be doing, which is in my recording studio or in a painting studio upstairs. It's one of the two, and yeah, fewer demands. So in a sense, it's a bit of found time for me, which is a very fortunate, seems like an incredibly insensitive thing to say when people are actually genuinely suffering in this environment. And my heart goes out to them, mm-hmm. but I live a very privileged life, and this has allowed me to finish the mixing of the record with our bathhouse engineer after 2 weeks of quarantine. It allowed me to do the artwork for the album and spend a considerable amount of time sequencing the songs to get it right for, you know, and, you know, I guess you're doing it for everyone else out there, but I'm really doing it for me.
Well, it's kind of a lost
art. It all makes sense. Yeah.
It's kind of a lost art, the idea of sequencing songs for an album now, because so often if people are listening on Spotify or whatever, they're not listening from start to finish. But there was a time when there were experts in the field, people whose job it was to figure out what sequence the song should go in so that they flowed and kept you engaged for the entire thing. I'm glad to hear that it's something that's important to you, because it's really important to me. I like listening to records all the way through.
The album is very important to me. And, you know, I spent years collecting thousands of albums, old school vinyl albums. And then I had thousands of CDs, and then I had, you know, cassette tapes and DATs, and then I had 35 days of music on my laptop. And now I listen to vinyl records again, because of all those changes that we've gone through, it's still a more satisfying medium. It just feels more complete, more organic, holding the record cover in your hand. I love that stuff. That's still where my heart is. And it was very much, very important to me that this record be on vinyl. We aren't putting it out on CD. It'll go to streaming once it's released later this week, so people can stream it and get it on iTunes and whatever else. But the most important thing is that it exists as a double vinyl album.
Craig, was it always meant to be a double album, or was there just, there were that many songs, we thought, okay, this is what we're going to do?
I would say, from the way Rob felt about it, it was always meant that way. And so I started to jump on that vision and complete each song. I thought, oh, well, this one, maybe it's not going to make it, or this one's not. But it's amazing how they all turned out to be part of something that made added to the record. I mean, that's a lot of tunes to put on anything. And I think,
always leave them wanting less, Craig. That's my motto.
Yeah. Well, the idea of the fact that we've been told for the last bunch of years that the album is dead, mm-hmm. you know, that people don't think that way anymore. They only want a little bite-sized thing. And I keep saying to everybody, well, it might be dead to you, but or it might be dead to somebody. But as long as it's not dead to me, I'm the one who's making it with somebody, or we're the ones making it. So it's still alive.
Yeah. Whenever I've written a bunch of books, and whenever I've written a book, no matter how kind of arcane the subject might be, I always think, if I like it, 10,000 other people will like it.
Right.
And that's all you need.
I based my whole life on that.
You're listening to my interview with Rob Baker and Craig Northey of Strippers Union. Check out their new album, The Undertaking, wherever you buy fine music.
Seriously, that's how we write songs. That's everything we did in the hip. That's what we do in Strippers Union.
Yeah.
It's like, there's nothing special about us. And if we like it, if we get off on this, other people will too.
Yeah. Well, there's people out there chasing hits. You know, that's a different world where you're beta testing and you're guessing and you're listening to what other people are doing and you're trying to fit yourself into a position in the rankings of those other people. And none of us operate that way. Rob, myself, nobody I know as a musician operates that way. They just go, I like this. This is weird. What do you think?
You talk about sequencing albums, and Ziggy Stardust, the album that I probably listened to more than any other album ever.
Right,
when one song's end, in my head, I hear the beginning of the next song. And yes. I'm sure that happens to you as well with albums that you love. Absolutely. It's like it's one long song to me.
Yeah, it truly was. What a glorious time when the album was king and people really put thought into the album as a concept in itself. And unfortunately, not enough people did it or did it well. but there are albums that stand the test of time. Bowie and Zeppelin and Stones had a few and whatever.
Marvin Gaye had a couple. Records.
Oh, Norm, yeah.
Marvin Gaye had a couple.
Yep. Stevie just one. Like Stevie yeah, one you put the needle down, and when side one ends, it's like, wow,
yeah,
flip it over. Let's keep going.
Find the Strippers Union double album The Undertaking wherever you legally download or buy music. Now let's meet Cree composer and artist Nigel Irwin. He's been brought on as Nagamo's co-creative director. Well, what's Nagamo? It is the world's first indigenous creative production music library for media. Their goal is to provide indigenous composers with much-needed opportunities to showcase their talents in the industry while allowing clients access to this groundbreaking music that spans all genres and all nations. Here's my Zoom interview with Nigel Irwin. I want to go back just a little ways. I was reading about you, and you were a tap dancer at age 9. You were doing theater. Is that where your love of music came from?
That's interesting. Yeah, you went right back. I often cite those early years of tap dancing as like the way I got music into me. Music is very rhythmic. And when you're on stage dancing, certainly in the musical theater capacity, you can't help but have that sort of tempo and rhythm. Just kind of, I'm always tapping my toes now. I'll probably be tapping my toes for the rest of my life, even though I don't tap dance anymore. But
this new job at Nagamo sounds like a dream job for you. It combines your love of music, something that's been with you for as long as you've been with us, and your love of community. What can you tell me about it?
You know, as an artist, I think you're always looking for truth and you're always looking for a way to express who you are as a person. And, you know, as we stated earlier, I grew up in theater and I, you know, love my love for music and storytelling. It didn't feel, it came to a point where it wasn't truthful if I wasn't speaking to the indigenous, you know, part of me. I'm a Cree man. And as I was getting older and realizing sort of what that means, you know, I was taught, you know, my elders taught me that just by being an indigenous person, it's kind of a political statement in and of itself. And so, you know, I've been on this journey to kind of fuse those two worlds, you know, find a way to express myself through my art, but also be true to who I am as a indigenous person. And it seems important, you know, now more than ever to kind of speak that into the world. And so this is a job where I've finally successfully been able to fuse both of those worlds. I've been kind of on the peripheries of both for so long, and whether it's, you know, just through music or plays or whatever I was doing, or if it's community work and facilitating and volunteering, just being able to bring those two together is a great thing.
You're listening to my interview with Cree composer and artist Nigel Irwin. And I was going to ask you about this because I do have a quote here from you where you say that you were taught that being an indigenous person is inherently political. How so?
Well, I think Canada being built on what it's built on is always at odds with its history, and it's always at odds with where it's going to go. I mean, everyone has a different vision of what that sort of looks like. And I think Indigenous people, what we're really striving for is sovereignty, and in some way, you know, many ways, reclamation. And you know, we always talk about reconciliation. I mean, that's a Canada-wide conversation. And that's not going to be going away anytime soon. I mean, we're only moving towards more political spaces and more, you know, divided conversations. And I think everyone's just trying to speak their truth and, you know, find their place in the world. Indigenous people have had, you know, a hard time of it for sure, but we have so much to offer. And you know, it's the facts are the facts. We've lived in a time where practicing our culture, speaking our language, these things were not only frowned upon, but illegal at some point. So the damage has been done in a way that culture is not readily accessible to someone like myself. I didn't grow up on the reserve. I grew up, you know, I guess you would call me an urban native. You know, I'm tasked with the job of, you know, discovering that stuff for myself and learning that stuff for myself. It's a burden. It's, you know, it's something that I'll be doing for the rest of my life. And with that comes a bit of, you know, not, I suppose somebody needs to kind of answer for that situation that we're in. And so when we step out as Indigenous people and we share our art and we share our stories and we, you know, we speak up, it's gonna come with it so much baggage and context and subtext. I think you just can't really escape it. People, certainly now more than ever, they know the history of, you know, residential schools and 60 Scoop and whatnot. Mm. And there's just so much more to learn and so much more to grow. And I think, you know, just being an Indigenous person, you kind of have to, you know, reconcile that in some way.
And well, let's talk about Nagamo and what its actual purpose is. So I think it's a really cool idea. It's the world's first Indigenous creative production music library for media. So if I am looking for music for a film or a television show or radio program, whatever it might be, I would go to you. And then what happens when I go to you?
Well, one of two things can happen. You can look at our library that's ever growing and expanding. And in that, we have a wide range of music from many different composers and creators. It's exciting because you can search through our catalog via mood, instrumentation, genre. You get those sort of things. But we also have nation built in there as well. So if you're looking for certain nations or sectors of Canada, First Nations, Inuit, Métis groups, we've got that covered. And it's only going to be growing and expanding from here on out. So often, you know, productions have limited budgets. Bringing on a composer wholesale and just having them compose the entire project, bit of a budget thing there. So you can come to our site, you can see all sorts of music and in different contexts and find what you're looking for. And it sort of assists in the storytelling. We also are building out an agency side of things as well. So if you have a specific composer in mind or someone from a certain community that you're looking to connect with, we can facilitate that as well. So it's kind of a two-pronged approach and we're very excited about. But the library is sort of our bread and butter, and it's only going to be growing from here.
And this is something that you've been involved with, this kind of work, for a while. I was reading about storytellers, which I thought was a really cool project where you remixed traditional singers and drum circles and chants and that kind of thing, and then remixed them for contemporary projects. Tell me a little bit about that, maintaining respect for what had come before, but putting, I guess, a new spin on it.
Yeah, certainly. So storytellers is a step in the direction of respect, because I think a lot of projects and a lot of productions were going ahead with quote unquote Indigenous music that wasn't necessarily made by Indigenous people themselves. And so there was a bit of a need, a bit of an opportunity there to kind of correct the course a little bit. So we partnered, Bedtracks is a music house in Toronto.
You're listening to my interview with, you know, Cree musician Nigel Irwin.
Wanted to rectify it. Partnered with Imaginative, who is a great film festival international, and they saw the need for it as well. I was brought in on that first iteration of the project. I was just a musician, composer at the time, and I knew some friends in the company. And it kind of just spiraled from there. It was a really exciting time, actually. The first thing we did is we brought in drum groups into the studio, some throat singers as well, recorded them, and then sent that out to our remixers to sort of blend into contemporary sounds. Now, the big red flag here is, what are we recording and what are we using? We certainly don't want to be touching traditional or, you know, sacred songs. Songs in Indigenous culture are profoundly beautiful things. They need to be treated with the utmost care. We make sure that the music we're recording is original compositions, stuff created by our drum groups and our composers that is free to use. There's also a concept called universal songs, which don't necessarily belong to one nation, but are sort of a collective song. So we look into those as well. But our main thing is original compositions. It was just the easiest way to avoid any sort of stepping on any toes. Because what's exciting about it is that cross collaboration where we can, you know, send out a, what was originally a Cree composer, sending it to an Ojibwe remixer, you know, and suddenly there's a whole new sound kind of being made here. It's almost like a sonic powwow back in the day, you know, when you would just sort of blend groups together. We're kind of hearing the same thing with the music being made.
You have touched in your own work on so many different styles. Reconcile sounds like a pop song to me in a lot of ways. There's rock and roll that you play. There's all sorts of things here. How has working with these archives and hearing new things and in some ways helping facilitate creating new sounds inspired your own songwriting and your own work?
I'm in the middle of a project myself, but of course Negamo has taken front and center for so long that I've just been really focused on getting this project off the ground and getting it, you know, where it needs to be. It's interesting when we go back to the beginning where I was talking about fusing, you know, music and expressing what's true to me, and I can't get away with just writing a simple pop song anymore or just a little rock and roll thing. You know, I've heard too much and I've experienced too much at this point. So the music I'm sitting on and I'm creating right now is really focused on sort of displaying this work that I've been doing and finding a way to share it. Certainly, I mean, just being able to access indigenous singers who are willing to collaborate with me, you know, that's super exciting, where I've got a song to a certain point and then I share it with one of my friends who offer a bit of their, you know, vocalizations or what have you on it. It just elevates the song and kind of brings it to a new space. And thematically in the songwriting, I tend to try to touch on these themes anyway, lyrically, but it's the voices, I think, that really count at the end of the day. So
I think songs like Reconcile and Savage, which is a song that tries to reclaim a word that is often used in a derogatory sense, are interesting because of what you've just said. You take songs like Reconcile, sounds like a pop song, but then you start listening to the lyrics, and it could be a couple reconciling good, but then there's a much larger life to it when you actually sit down and think about what is being said in the lyrics.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, you're kind of preaching to the choir when you're talking to other indigenous folks about reconciliation and you know, Skoden, Studas, all these things. It's in the culture anyway. I think the main mission here is to connect with Canada, you know, the larger body of Canada. And my approach has always been, you know, find that common ground, you know, thematically. I think Reconcile is a good example of that, where on the surface it's just a relationship song. Everyone can relate to that. You know, if there's a falling out, there's some complications, there's, you know, miscommunication, but there's always a chance to kind of bring it back together and find you know, find a way to reconcile. Obviously there is that deeper context there, but you can't expect people to grasp these bigger issues if they don't feel it, you know, inside first. And I think if you just find that way to kind of touch people a little closer and a little closer to home, something that they can relate to, then they can see themselves in Indigenous people. They can see themselves in that struggle. And I think there's probably a better chance that we'll, you know, come to terms with each other and you know, where we need to go.
Negamo is up and running now. It's a thing. It's in the world. When will we hear the songs that you were just talking about, the things that you've been working on that have been sort of pushed to the side burner temporarily?
Yeah, it's on its way. I think I've got a spring release in mind, late April, early May. There's going to be some more music coming from me. You can check into the Imaginative Film Festival as well. Late February, I'll be debuting a video with a couple new singles on there as well. And yeah, it's a matter of time, I think. Yeah.
It's always a matter of time. Certainly. Everything's about finding the time, isn't it? Nigel, thanks so much for this. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Well, miigwech for talking to us as well.
That was my interview with Cree composer and musician Nigel Irwin. To find out more about Nagamo, go to nagamo.ca. We've spoken to a number of musicians on the show today. The one thing they all have in common is that they're all being creative and writing music during a pandemic. So I wanted to give the last couple of minutes of the show to Jim Cuddy of Blue Rodeo to talk about how he works in isolation. Here's Jim. Jim, you have said that this was a fairly fertile time for you in terms of songwriting. Do you think that in some way it was a way of dealing with the anxiety that comes along with this?
It's difficult for me to say because I'm at a different point in my career. I've had a 35-year career, so the idea of having 6 months of not performing was pretty odd to break the habit of performing, but it was also a bit of a blessing to just be able to, I think Alexis knows, writers usually write in isolation, at least part of the time. I mean, if they're collaborating, I get it, but isolation is no, that's not new to me, and that's sort of the way I write. So I think that I have heard a number of musicians say that it was really creatively restrictive for them, that they did not feel inspired, and they just had nothing that they wanted to do. So, and I appreciate that. I think that sometimes, if it had happened to me 15 years ago, I think I was always writing with a in mind of either going to record that or going to play it live. And having that motivation really moved me forward. And now I think I write for the purity of writing. And obviously I want to do something with it. But the actual act of writing and finishing a song is so overwhelmingly satisfying to me that it didn't crush my spirit.
Great words from a great man. Don't let it crush your spirit. That was Jim Cuddy talking about writing music while in isolation. That's the show for today. I want to thank all my guests, Rob Baker and Craig Northey of Strippers Union. Find their album, The Undertaking, wherever you buy fine music. And look for Nigel Allen at nagamo.ca. Finally, a thanks, as always, to Jim Cuddy for lending some wisdom to the show. Most of all, though, my biggest thanks, as always, goes to you for listening. I'm Richard Krause. Stay healthy, stay happy, stay safe, and we'll talk again soon.